Session number 8655, reel 3.
Mr. Weiberg, reel 3. You mentioned the camel's milk. Did you suffer any effects?
No.
From drinking it?
No.
While you're actually out on this outpost, how did you keep in touch with the battalion?
I think the only way of keeping in touch would have been by vehicle of some sort. I think I must have had a truck. I think I must have had a 1500 weight truck with me, and if anything happened, I would have had to have sent this truck back. 40 miles, it would have done it in, I suppose, a couple of hours.
Did you have to make regular reports back to battalion?
No, I don't think I did. I just had to write these reports on the ford and the road, state of the road.
How were you resupplied while you were there?
There must have been, I don't remember, but there must have been probably a 1300 weight truck was set down from battalion headquarters with rations.
These trucks that you were using, were they integral to the battalion, or were they service corps?
No, they were integral to they were battalion transport.
So the battalion was motorised, was it?
Well, it wasn't motorised to the extent that it had enough vehicles to carry all the men. No, it was a motorised unit meant really that there was enough transport for all the men to ride. It meant, in our case, that there was enough transport to carry all the rations, reserve ammunition, kit, large packs of the men. I think we later called it B echelon.
When you marched them back, the 40 miles or so, how was that organised?
Well, we just marched along the road in a column, as a column. We did have a vehicle to carry reserve ammunition and rations, and in fact I used to allow the men to take in turns to ride next to the driver. In fact, I was the only member of that expedition who walked literally all the way. And of course, being near the river, we spent 2 nights on the way. We arrived back at the battalion very early on the third day. We were able to camp by the side of the river and bathe in the river. That wasn't very appetizing because the camel dung used to sort of float past as you were bathing, but it was nice really to get into the water after getting so hot and dusty and sweaty.
Did you have regular stops at intervals?
Oh yes, I think we carried out the old original drill, which was to 10-minute rest in every hour.
It was a standard march discipline.
Yes, yes.
Did the men stand up to it well?
Oh, yes. We had no trouble. They didn't look happy doing it, of course, but, I mean, they all managed it all right.
And was it your first sustained route march?
Yes. Yes, it was.
So how did you find it?
Oh, just boring. It's always better for somebody who's got some responsibility because it gives them something else to think about, of course. I think it's worse for the private soldier who's got nothing else to think about except his aching shoulders or his blisters on his feet or whatever it is.
Now, you say you had by this stage been put into the Indian Infantry Brigade, and I think you said the Marathas were in it. Who were the other infantry?
The other infantry battalion was the 3rd 12th Royal Frontier Force Regiment.
And did your battalion have anything to do with them directly?
Well, we used to meet from time to time because we sometimes, just in the course of taking over one another's positions.
And how did your men get on with them?
Oh, well, the Indians and the British soldiers got on very well together. No trouble at all. They would pull each other's legs a bit and laugh, and that was perfectly all right.
What happened then after this spell of outpost duty? What's the next thing?
Well, then we got back to the battalion area, and then there was training going on there, mostly on there was a range of some sort, and firing live rounds on the range. And then we weren't there very long. And then we were all sent to Galabat, which is a small Sudanese town on the Abyssinian frontier, opposite an Abyssinian town called Metemma. And we took over from 10 Brigade, which is another brigade of the division. And then, of course, we were in contact with the enemy.
You say you were firing on the range. What sort of ranges were they firing at?
Well, I think it was pretty primitive range, with sort of a bank of earth at one end for primitive targets and to stop the bullets. It was just, you see, firing rifles and light machine guns, you can't do it anywhere, obviously. You've got to have a properly set up range out somewhere where you're not going to do any damage to other people. And I think this, the Hassem el-Gerba area provided this. It probably didn't exist in Khartoum, that I recall.
But what would the distance from the firing point to the targets be?
I should think 500 yards. I think the old Lee-Enfield 303 was effective up to 1,000 yards, but I should think we fired over about 500 yards.
What was the general standard of musketry?
It varied enormously. You see, some of the troops, they just couldn't... they just somehow couldn't do it. I think it's coordination of hand and eye, and some chaps didn't somehow ever really do it. I think they mostly hit the target, but, I mean, to get a bull was quite an achievement, really.
Was it a full course of musketry that was fired, or just a sort of refresher?
Well, it was all refresher, because they'd all done it before. I mean, that was how Kirby managed to shoot the provost sergeant, because although he was a very dull sort of man and a rather stupid man, the one thing in the world that he was any good at was handling his rifle, because he'd handled it and been trained in it for so long, so frequently. And it's ironic, really, that the use he put, the one thing he could do.
How did you get down to Galabat?
We went in motor vehicles. There's no railway to Galabat.
What was the road like? Was it a good road?
I think that was the road that was corrugated.
So it must have been a fairly uncomfortable
journey. Yeah, it was an uncomfortable journey, yeah.
And how long did the handover take from the brigade that was in place to your own one?
Well, not very long. I think we took over from the 3rd 12th, and by this time I had a different company commander, another young regular officer, and it was just he and I, and we met with our opposite numbers, whose company position we were taking over, and they showed us where the defensive positions were, and told us one or two things about how often we might be shelled or how often we might be bombed from the air. And they departed and we occupied their positions.
Did you move in daylight?
Yes.
What were their positions like?
Well, they were these... you couldn't dig very far down because you got down to rock after about 2 feet, so you dug down as far as you could. And we were, and my company, B Company, was in a reserve position. It wasn't actually in the front line defences. And we had these shallow trenches covered over with grass shelters, shelters from the sun to provide shade. And then when the Italian aircraft came over and dropped bombs, which they did from time to time, you just lay in these shelters and hope for the best.
How far from the actual front line was the position you occupied then in the reserve?
I suppose about 500 yards.
Could you actually see the front line?
No, you couldn't because of the vegetation. This was the Galabat area was again an improvement on where we'd been previously. It was hillier, more trees, and elephant grass, but of course a lot of thorn bush. So no, you couldn't see because of the trees in the way.
How far ahead of your positions could you see?
Well, if you got onto the road, you could see down the road. Otherwise, if you're off the road, you couldn't see any distance at all, really.
What were you then supposed to do if there were an attack upon the forward positions?
Well, supposing the Italians actually advanced in force from their positions in Galabat and Metemma. You see, they had captured Galabat, and the Essex regiment had tried to recapture it and had failed, so the Italians were still there. And if they'd attacked our positions, then their forward companies would have attempted to, of course, beat them off. If they had failed and the Italians had occupied our forward positions, then our job would have been to counterattack. And this was one of the teachings at that period, was the importance of timing your counterattack just right. In other words, to catch the enemy just at that point where he's captured the position but hasn't yet had time to consolidate.
So you get them when they're blown?
Yeah.
And had you reconnoitred and marked routes to go forward for such a counterattack?
Yes, I think we would have visited the company commander and I, and probably the platoon sergeant majors would have visited the forward company and see what it looked like. Yes.
What were the positions like? Were they, again, three trenches per section or something like that?
Yes, that sort of thing. Yes.
Were they laid out in any particular pattern?
Well, as far as the forward companies were concerned, they were on higher ground with the with the defensive position slightly in advance of the crest, so as they had a field, they could see anybody coming.
So on a forward slope?
Yes, yes they were, which in some cases is of course the wrong teaching, but in this case it seemed to be the best thing to do.
Could you actually see the Italian positions from the front line?
No, you couldn't because of the trees and vegetation.
Do you know how far away they were?
Yes, they were. Difficult to say how in distance. I mean, I used to think of it in terms of that you could, on patrol, you could patrol in no man's land without necessarily alerting the Italian positions. If you wanted to deliberately alert them, which we did have to do later on, you had to deliberately go far enough towards them before you got any reaction. Otherwise, you could wander about in no man's land without them reacting.
Was there a great deal of patrolling?
Yes, there was. We had a standing patrol at a place called Jebel Zariba, which means Thornbush Hill, and that was connected by telephone to battalion headquarters, and there was a platoon standing patrol there all the time, day and night. And I was there one night, and you were supposed to patrol during the night, which I did. I just took a section and wandered about, but got mixed up with these thorn bushes and made a lot of noise. Didn't really do any good. And then the next morning, I was relieved about soon after dawn by another platoon commanded by a chap called Mike Jacobs from D Company. And you had a particular route you had to follow to and from, so that you weren't seen by the enemy. And for this reason, you used these dry river beds, which provided a certain amount of cover. And there was one in particular called Cor el Gir. Cor also means river, bed. And on the way back on this occasion, I heard firing, which seemed to come from Jebel Zariba. So I went back, and I told my platoon sergeant to bring up the platoon, and I hurried back. But all I found was Mike Jacobs in a tree with his binoculars. And by that time, the firing had stopped, and that didn't turn out to be anything. But then one used to be told sometimes to deliberately draw the enemy's fire. Because what apparently was happening, we didn't realise this at first, although we came to realise it later on, was that the enemy in Metemmer and Galabat, they were proposing to withdraw from those positions altogether and retire to Gondar, which was the provincial capital, about 100 miles into the interior in a strong position in the hills, about 7,000 feet above sea level. And in order to disguise their intention and in order to prevent us from interfering with their withdrawal, the expression was, dominated no man's land. And to do this, they pushed their forward posts further and further towards us. And one day I was told to take my platoon. Well, I wasn't told to take my platoon. I was told to take... There was a special platoon which had been formed for this particular purpose, which was normally commanded by a chap called Peter Bairstow. But for some reason, I was told to take this platoon and go out and find out where the enemy were.
It was a reconnaissance
platoon. Yes. Off we went, and we went out to Jebel and Zareba and passed through there, and then we went a bit further on and went through a small, deserted native village, and then we came to a sort of small hill which had been burnt bare and which was known on the maps as Left Golf Course. Somebody had named it Left Golf Course for some reason, and I took a section up to the top of this hill, just hoping to be able to see from there, and the section commander was a chap called Fretwell. I knew him quite well because he came from B Company. And he started laughing. I suppose it was nerves. Anyway, I said, shut up, Fretwell. And he said, I can't help it, sir. And anyway, we went back to the bottom of the hill. We rejoined the rest of the platoon and continued the advance. And then the leading section got to a clearing, and as they entered the clearing, they were fired on from immediately in front. Corporal Fretwell had stopped laughing by this time, and he took the Bren gun away from the private soldier who was carrying it, and he stood up, firing this Bren gun from the hip, and which was a foolhardy thing to do, but he survived, and I pushed out the sections on either side to guard against any attack from the flank, and nothing much more happened. And as I'd been told only to get information and not to attack anybody, I then withdrew the platoon to this little ruined native village, and where we sort of reorganised and discovered that nobody had been hurt, and we returned to the battalion position, and I reported what I discovered, and you know, we hoped to give it an accurate position on the map. And then, if one was on patrol at Jebel Zareba during the day, one was expected to sort of reconnoitre, to probe forward. And doing this on a subsequent occasion, I got fired on much sooner than we had done on that previous occasion. So this showed that the Italians were pushing their outposts further forward.
Did they ever attempt a sort of forcible reconnaissance of your own forward positions?
No.
So the patrolling wasn't that aggressive?
No, the patrolling was entirely defensive. I mean, they pushed their post further forward towards us. Well, that was a defensive process.
When you got fired on across the clearing on the first occasion, did you have any clear idea of where it was coming from?
Well, yes, I did, because there was this clearing, and it seemed to me that the enemy position would be on the other side of the clearing to give them a field of fire.
Did you see any movement or muzzle flashes?
No, I didn't. Fretwell was there with his section. He was taking care of the situation very adequately, and so I was concerned to get the other sections out on the flanks. To make sure that we weren't surprised by any of the enemy coming round on the side.
Were you able to make any estimate of the numbers of enemy?
Well, I thought it consisted of a few men with one light machine gun. They didn't fire any mortars, LMG fire.
And how did you judge that? Was that just on the volume of fire?
Yes.
Was the fire accurate?
No, I don't think it was. It didn't hit any of us. I didn't see where it was going. I just heard it, and I think they had to keep... Once Freppel started firing at them, standing up, I think that if they could see him, I'm not sure that they could see him, but if I think they probably could. And I think once they saw him firing at him, at them from the hip, standing up, I think that made them keep their heads down.
How far away from you do you think they were when they opened?
Not very far. I should think 30 yards.
So presumably the vegetation was dense.
Yes, it was pretty dense, yes. Because this hill that we went up, which was burnt, I mean, that's why I went up that particular hill, because it was burnt and you could see.
And you could see over the top.
Yes, you could see that there was nobody on it, you see.
And the second time you were shot at, was that just simply out of the vegetation again?
Yes, I don't recall any of that, except that it did happen. That's my only recollection, that did happen, because this was all part of the process of realising that they were pushing their posts further towards us.
Did you get any casualties on that
second
occasion?
No.
You mentioned this platoon that had been specially tasked for this sort of reconnaissance function. Do you happen to know how the men were chosen for that particular platoon? How was it formed?
I think each company commander was told to recommend certain men in his company who would then be to go into this platoon. But how the company commander would choose, I don't know, because in my experience, you couldn't tell how a man was going to behave under fire until it actually happened. The most unlikely people you would have thought behave with great courage under fire, and the sort of people you might have thought would have been staunch under fire wilted. And there was no way, I don't think there was really any way of knowing beforehand.
And this man Fretwell, it sounds as though he was rather unnerved initially. How did he perform later on?
He performed, when it came to the point, he performed very well. I think the laughing was nervous anticipation. I think actually he was quite enjoying himself. I think he was one of these chaps who liked the feeling of a certain amount of the anticipation of something going to happen like that, of danger. And certainly when it came to the point, he was very decisive in what he did. He made no bones about it. He just took the gun away from the private soldier and stood up there and fired it back. He was later killed in the Western Desert, unfortunately.
What about the other soldiers? How did they react to being under fire?
Well, you just all throw yourself to the ground initially, and then I said to one corporal, take your section over to the left, and the other section I kept with me, because the other flank was the bare hill and you could see if anybody was coming that way. And they just... And then as we were... Then I gave the order to withdraw, so we withdrew through the trees, and the platoon sergeant said to the rear section, shoot back at them, make them, you know, to frighten them. Yes, that's right.
Do you know if you had any, the battalion as a whole had any casualties from patrolling?
There was an action carried out by A Company, which was a company operation, in which they captured an Italian position and they had some casualties.
But that would be a fighting patrol.
Yes. Well, it was an attack on an Italian position. Yes. Well, no, it wasn't really a patrol. I don't know if there were casualties on patrol. We didn't have any.
Do you know if any casualties were claimed as against the Italians from patrols?
No, I don't know of any.
Did you take any prisoners?
No. Not at that stage. Later on, when they actually withdrew from these positions and we followed them down the road, then we did, yes.
Did you know who you were facing?
Well, we knew we were facing a mixture of white Italians and Eritrean troops, because, of course, the Italians had been in charge of Eritrea for many years by then, and they had Eritrean troops.
But Did you know what regiments they were or anything like that?
Well, I didn't know. I don't recall that I knew.
Did you ever actually see an Italian soldier, clearly, while you were...
Not at Gallabat, no. The aeroplanes used to come over and drop bombs on us, and they used to shell us, but their shells weren't very good. They didn't burst. So, altogether, it wasn't a particularly dangerous sort of situation.
When the aircraft came and bombed you, did they come in large numbers or in small numbers?
Well, about, I suppose, half a dozen. But they had proper bombers. We didn't have proper bombers, you see. The RAF just had these Hardys, these biplanes, which they used to... Well, I only ever saw them once do anything. They came over and dive-bombed the Italian positions and strafed them. But the Italians had these bombers. I imagine that they were in Abyssinia because they'd been used against the Abyssinians themselves originally. And they used to come over. They were very slow, of course. All aircraft were slow in those days. And you could hear them coming. And you used to have time to finish your breakfast and then go and get in a trench and, you know, hope that they'd miss, which they usually did.
How high up were they usually?
Oh, I don't know. I'm very bad at judging height in that sense. Not very high. I mean, low flying by today's standards.
Did they actually cause any casualties or damage?
Not that I know of, no. They did to the Essex. This is why the Essex failed in their endeavour. It was because they were bombed and forced to withdraw by bombing that they failed to capture Gallabat in the first place.
How do your men feel about being bombed? Did they get used to it?
Yes, I mean, it didn't last long. I think people adapt to that sort of thing.
What about shelling? Did the shelling actually land shells accurately on your positions?
Yes, they used to land. They didn't. I don't recall that they caused any casualties, but they used to land in the battalion area. But that wasn't very bad. Actually, we had artillery superiority. We had the Sussex Battery at the Surrey and Sussex Yeomanry with 25-pounders, and they used to shell the Italian positions quite a lot.
Did they do any counter-battery work for you to hit the...
Yes, they did. Yes, and they had a post where they used to view the Italian positions through a telescope, and I think they were quite helpful.
Do you know about the details of this attack put in by your A Company?
I did at the time, but I can't remember. I haven't got that in my notes because we didn't take part in that. So I don't really remember very much about it, except that they did, in fact, attack this Italian position and capture it. But I don't think they stayed there. Having captured it and caused as much disarray and discomfort to the Italians as possible, I think they then withdrew.
So essentially, this was a raid.
Yes.
Could you actually see the fort at Gallabat from your position?
No.
It sounds like you were really involved in a sort of stalemate on that front.
Yes. That's right.
That time. How long were you there before things started moving?
Well, we got there, I suppose, beginning of December. We were there the whole of December, January, 2 months. 2 months.
And how did the position become fluid then? How did things change?
Well, then this patrolling went on, and then one morning a patrol from another battalion, the 3rd, 5th Marathas, I think, they went out and to contact the enemy in the usual way, and they didn't make any contact, and they got to Gallabat Fort, and it was empty. In the meantime, a mobile column had been detailed that was meant to chase the Italians down the road as soon as they had been... And we knew that they had withdrawn. As a matter of fact, prior to that, the brigadier thought he knew when they were going to withdraw, and he gave...